Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferrone Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the EML team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our burning questions for today are, why is it challenging to identify a disability for an L or ML? And what does MTSS look like for Ls or MLs? And here to respond to these questions is my very special guest, Jamie Scripps. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jamie, could you please introduce yourself? Tell us your special areas of interest and what drew you to working with Ls?
So sure. My name is Jamie Scripps. I am an English as a new language teacher on special assignment for Rush Henrietta School District. I've been working for this school district for, I think, about the past 17 years. Before that, my undergrad, when I first went to school, I went to school for speech language pathology and audiology. Mm-hmm. And when I first started working as a speech path, that was the first 7 years of my career, they would always give me the L's. And at that time, there were not a lot of ENL teachers. So the government was asking people to go back to school to get a certification. So I went back, and that it was always my other languages was always my interest. So I went back for linguistics and got a certificate in as an ESL teacher and have never looked back. And I really love merging the two careers. So speech path and ENL really work well together.
Fantastic. And, you know, I'm a linguistics person myself. I have my first master's is in linguistics. Mm-hmm. So I have a love for linguistics as well. Mm-hmm. So I share that with you. So you and I, we actually met through New York State TESOL, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are the special ed SIG.
I was also on the Rochester Buffalo SIG as well.
Okay. Okay. So the region also, correct? Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we actually met at New York State TESOL in person. And mm-hmm. I saw your presentations on supporting Ls with disabilities and MTSS. And it was very fascinating, all of the work. And I thought, this would be an amazing opportunity for the podcast because you did a lot of amazing work in developing this program at your school district. So I thought it would be great to share it with the world.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So I know that we know that there are challenges with identifying Ls with disabilities. What's problematic about identifying and serving Ls, MLs with disabilities?
So, as you know, there are many issues with identifying Ls with disabilities. We have over-identification, right, and we have under-identification. Mm-hmm. So students with disabilities and second language acquisition can look very similar.
Yes.
And they, you know, many of the characteristics cross over. Mm-hmm. So you really need to look at second language acquisition and understand the stages of second language acquisition, understand the student, understand their background, has there been trauma, have they acculturated? There's many things to take into consideration. Mm-hmm. And if someone is not taking all of those factors into consideration, and not only about the student, but about the instruction, and if the instruction is appropriate for an English language learner, if you're not taking all of those things into consideration, it's easy for an English language learner to appear like they may have a disability. And then that's where you get the over-identification.
Right.
On the flip side, some people are very hesitant to say that an English language learner has a disability because they feel like they have no way to differentiate that. But what we have found is that there are ways that you can differentiate. If you look in the research, but that's not to say that it's easy.
Right. Absolutely. And sometimes it's even cultural, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you need to be aware of so many different factors.
Right.
So even right down to even the language, specifics in the language.
Right.
You know, if the student is having difficulty reading, you really need to understand the sound system of their language.
Yes, absolutely.
So it can come down to very minute things that you really need to look into before jumping to a conclusion.
Mm. So we could probably talk about a whole episode about the difference between language difference and disability. You kind of give us some idea of what things we might look for to distinguish.
So you want to make sure that you are trying to use the least biased tools that are available, because if you are going by the standardized testing for monolingual English speaking peers, then you are missing the mark, because that was not normed on our L's. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that we look at is the second language acquisition. And Dr. Catherine Collier put together the works from Cummings and Crashen and put the stages of second language development into a nice chart.
Yes.
And it's based on how long they've been in the language. So 0 to 6 months, 6 months to a year to 2 years, 2 years to 3 years, three to five. And 5 to 7. So that right there is a good place to start, mm-hmm. so that you understand what the stages are for second language development. So we use that in many different ways. Another tool is a test that we may have differing opinions on, but it is one that all L's in New York State test and that take, and that is the NISOSLAT.
Mm-hmm.
So the NISOSLAT is a test that is normed on L's, right? So, and the state has come up with quartiles that are expectations for our L's based upon how other L's have done on this test. So you're basing it against other L's. So if you're looking at the NISOSLAT, you don't want to be just looking at, okay, that student was emerging and now they're transitioning. You want to be looking at their quartiles. So if they were emerging 1 in the first quartile and now they're transitioning 2, well, that's good. Then they've made 5 quartiles of growth. So that's great. But if they were emerging in quartile 4 and now they are transitioning in quartile 1, then that's not so much growth. So quartiles are really important to be looking at. You want to be looking at their modality scores.
Mm-hmm.
So each year, looking at each modality and seeing, have they gone up? Have they gone down? They shouldn't go down. You want to further analyze it by seeing, is it in the receptive skills? Is it in the expressive skills? So those are two tools that everybody could use tomorrow, right? Because they're at your fingertips. Other tools that we use are peer comps. Mm-hmm. So we have enough L's in our district to be able to compare them to other L's with the same amount of years, the same level starting as an L when they first came in. And now let's see how many years they've been here. And then what is their level now? So what's important for that is that you start with the same level, because entering L's, they will take around five to seven years to get to commanding. But if they started at expanding, it shouldn't take the same amount of time.
Right.
There's a great little video webinar that the state has out on how to read how they score the NISOSLAT, mm-hmm. and it'll show you the average time that it takes our L's to score commanding based upon their first level. So that's important, is to compare them to their peers. It doesn't have to be the same language. What's more important is time. It's the time. Another tool that we use is the Ortiz PVAT. So Samuel Ortiz created a great receptive vocabulary test it's a one word receptive vocabulary test. Mm-hmm. And that test was normed on L's. Mm-hmm. It's also normed on monolingual English speakers as well. Okay. So you can, when you get the scores from that test, you can see how your L scored against other L's with the same amount of time in being exposed to English. And you can also see how they're doing compared to monolingual English peers. And then it will give you a lot of strategies as well. So that's a really nice tool. And if people don't have that tool, because there's many.
I know. I actually have a question about the Ortiz PVAT though. Does that take into consideration the home language at all?
So it does, but what Samuel Ortiz has referenced in many of his webinars that he has out there is that it's more important the amount of time. So you do put into the equation the language as well, but it's more against time. Mm-hmm. It's more against time.
Okay. And I just wanted to clarify, when you said peer comps, you were talking about peer comparisons, right?
Oh, yes, I apologize.
That's okay. That's all right. Just want to clarify for our listeners that may not be familiar with, you know, with the shortened term and the lingo that we use. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I guess you started talking about assessments that are available to determine whether an L or an ML has a disability. But the Ortiz PVAT, that's more of like a language acquisition tool, right?
Yeah, so that is, for that one, that is more of a speech language assessment.
Okay.
So if a child has difficulty with single word receptive vocabulary, mm-hmm. that's a big red flag for a speech language.
Okay.
So what will happen is the test will tell you this child is suspected to have, you know, difficulty acquiring language.
Okay.
However, it also says that it must be backed up with other evidence, mm-hmm. right? So that's where you have to be collecting mm-hmm. more. So what we did with the Catherine Collier grid is we, with permission from Dr. Catherine Collier, we created an Excel grid and we broke the different components to the different times in language apart mm-hmm. and then assigned them to different boxes on the grid. And mm-hmm. you get 1 point if the student has mastered that skill, half a point if the student is working towards it, and zero if they are not even working towards it and they don't have it, if it's not evident at all. Mm-hmm. And then what we do is we tally up the scores. The Excel sheet will tally it up for us, and we will get scores 0 to 6 months out of 36. What's their score? 6 months to a year out of however many, what's their score? So now we can put it into a bar graph and we can see, mm-hmm. is this student meeting what they should be for their amount of time in the language? So if I have a student who's here for 3 to 5 years, but they still have a lot of gaps in the 6 months to a year or 1 to 2 years, now I see there's an issue, right? That's not typical second language acquisition. So what we're looking for, is it typical or atypical? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's another way that we use the Catherine Collier grid. We also have broken it apart so that teachers can look at it across levels and make a visual. So we will put in green what the student is able to do, orange what they're in the process of learning, and then red what they're not able to do. And then it's easy for us to create goals just looking at that visual. We go right to the orange in the lowest level and boom, we know what we need to work on.
And this tool is just as helpful for both L's and L's with disabilities, right?
Yes, exactly. So what these tools are for us is a way of distinguishing, right? Mm-hmm. But so that's where the MTSS comes into play.
Right.
So if a student...
So I wanted to just clarify about the Catherine Collier chart, because it's a really amazing resource. Mm-hmm. And it's separated by proficiency levels, right? It's got five different proficiency levels. Mm-hmm. And it's also separated into modalities, right? Because yes. There's a separate chart for listening, reading, writing, just so that our listeners get a good sense of what the extent of this chart.
Right. So it's not, it isn't separated by proficiency level. It's separated by time in the
yes.
In the language. So zero. So like I said, the 0 to 6 months. Gotcha. And it's based on receiving 1 hour of service per day.
Okay. Okay. What prompted you to create your own system of identifying and supporting L's with disabilities?
So when I was 23, one of the subjects that I was extremely interested in was how to differentiate a speech language disorder from English language learner and second language acquisition. And at that time, there wasn't much available other than getting an interpreter for the testing. Mm. This has been a passion of mine forever. So when I first started working here, or not even here anywhere, this issue just comes up over and over and over again. And you see people arguing at the table. And you see people, very often you see an ENL teacher come to the table and they want to defend their thoughts about a student, but right. They don't have the evidence. They don't have what they need to convince a psychologist or a speech pathologist that it's a potential learning disability or some type of a speech language issue versus just a difference. Mm-hmm. And I've watched it go back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah.
And I think it was in 2000, may have been 14 or 15, Catherine Collier came to Rochester. And I think it was at St. John Fisher College. Mm-hmm. And she gave a workshop. And before that, we had been exploring what might be out there. And when she showed this grid, it was like, aha, finally something. And she even said at the workshop, she's like, this is the first of its kind, you know?
Yeah.
So we ran with it and took it back and started just exploring its use and how, you know, and I would say that that's what everybody can start with, is to start with the grid and understanding and having others understand second right. language acquisition. Mm-hmm. And from there, in 2017, that's when I started in as an English as a new language TOSA, the teacher on special assignment. So I finally had the means to really bring people together. So Svetlana Stoll from, at the time it was RSC Task, mm-hmm. She was a bilingual special ed specialist. She and I teamed up and we had we brought together 60 plus of our stakeholders that would benefit from hearing about how to differentiate. And at that point, we still didn't have a lot of the tools, mm-hmm. but what Svetlana wanted to show was, you know, the issue of over-identification, the issue of under-identification. We had the issue of under-identification because many people were afraid to say that a student may have a disability when they can't really prove it.
Right.
So we brought 60 of our people together We had psychologists, we had speech pathologists, we had literacy coaches, we had principals and ENL teachers, as many people as we could get there. And from there, we said, well, this can't be a one and done, because first of all, we didn't even have enough information at that point, right? So this can't be a one and done. So from there, we showed the language acquisition grid. We showed how we could use it. But then what we did was we asked people who would be interested in joining a team, a focus team, to put more energy into this and really start digging deep to see what tools we could acquire. Mm-hmm. And we had, I think the first year, we had about 12 people on our team. We had speech paths, and we had ENL teachers, and we had literacy coaches. So it was a really nice mix, because mm-hmm. you're getting different viewpoints.
Right.
And from there, that's when we created the, that's when we decided to take the grid and put it on the Excel sheet, that we needed something that could be monitored. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's when we created the Excel sheet. Mm-hmm. That's when we started gathering a way to compare to their peers, so those peer comparisons. Mm-hmm. And we also bought the Ortiz PBAT. So we thought, okay, this is a great place to start. That was our start.
Right.
And again, one year is not going to be enough. So we brought everybody back to them. Mm-hmm. The same people that were at the first.
Right.
We brought them all back again the next year. Okay, how is this going? What do we need? We still don't have enough. What do we need? You know, what has changed at your school? What still needs to change? What we found was that people were really starting to understand the second language acquisition process. They were really starting to see what a typical L would look like and what an atypical L would look like. What a child with a learning disability would look like versus a child with second language acquisition. Again, we also use charts that show, Toronto had a great one out that showed the differences between a mm-hmm. learning disability and L's. So we continued the group. Mm-hmm. And from there, we really beefed up. We had a good interview. But I would also say another place that people can start is the initial interview, I would say, is one of the most important pieces of information you're ever going to have.
Yes.
So that is when you have your parents, you have them there. This is your time to ask them questions. Mm-hmm. Our interview takes me, I do all the interviews for the district. It's right. Nice if you can have one central person, because then they're all done consistent, you know, in a consistent yes. manner.
Yep.
It takes me roughly about an hour to get through that interview, just to see if I want a nice to tell the student. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to ask, what age were they when they said their first words? What age were they when they spoke in sentences? Did you ever have any concerns about your child's language? When you speak to them, do they understand you the first time, after two or three times, or after many times? Okay, they understand you after the first time. Are you speaking about simple words, or can you have a conversation with your child? You know, a lot of different questions. And we ask them in many different ways, because mm-hmm. sometimes a parent may answer it one way, and then you find out later, well, wait a minute, I need to dig deeper into this question. Mm-hmm. And I would say always digging deeper,
yes.
too. So very often when I say, can you have a conversation with your child? That's when I'll find out, well, no, you know, then, and you find out that they may be having some difficulty in their first language. That's what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. I'm not only looking for language dominance to see if they're going to take the NICETEL. Right. I'm also looking to see how their development was in their first language. Mm-hmm. So then when I do the student interview, yes, I'm looking to see, am I going to nice to tell them? Because that's my yep. first priority.
Right.
But then I use an interpreter for the student interview as well to see what their first language is like. Because I want, you know, for example, we have a question and it's a very telling question for the kindergartners. And it's what is, you know, if I have a banana and I have an orange, how are they the same? How are they different? Right. So, yeah. And it's amazing the different types of language you get from that question. Mm-hmm. And so in English, when they can answer that in English and they give me really great details, then it's, you know, it's like, okay, well, this kid's probably going to score commanding now, you know, but it also is interesting when you look at that in their native language. Mm-hmm. And if the parent is saying that that's the only language that they speak, and if they can't answer something like that, or answer, you know, I've had some students, you know, you ask them what their name is, and then the parent says, oh, well, they can't answer that. They don't know how to tell people what their name is. So then it's like, you know, or the age. So it's really important to also, as well as understanding second language development, it's also important for ENL teachers to get a crash course on first language development.
Yes.
Because first language development is not real dissimilar from language to language, right? There are milestones for mm-hmm. everybody. So if the parent is telling you that they didn't say their first words till they were four, that's a major red flag, right? So that's one that I would right away say, okay, we need to start monitoring this student. We need to put this student on a watch list, you know, so that we can make sure that we are looking to see how this is. And then I'll have the interpreter in. I recently had a student, you know, that isn't really speaking in their first language and they're five. Mm-hmm. So if I didn't do that interview, they might not know that. And they're just thinking it's a second language acquisition.
Right.
But it really is more a first language mm-hmm. acquisition. So that first interview is extremely important.
Yes.
And then from there, so we beefed up that with many, many more questions. And then we looked at other speech language. So Crowley, I think it's Laura Crowley, has a bunch out there. There's slams and solemn, and there's the non-word repetition task. So that non-word repetition task is really nice because it's non-biased in that it just has like syllables, but they're not even necessarily English syllables.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you can see how the child is processing language.
Mm-hmm.
The slams is a test where they have visuals and they have to tell you a story in their language. Mm-hmm. So you can look at their sequencing and their language ability. The psychologists and the speech language pathologists use something called the CLIM. So, well, the CLIM is a matrix. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it was created, I know Ortiz was one of the creators of the CLIM. So what a psychologist would do is give a standardized assessment without using an interpreter. Okay, so you do it in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the CLIM does, you factor in how much the student is affected by the first language, by the percentage of the day that they spend in the first language.
Mm-hmm.
So it has like highly affected, moderately affected, minimally affected, and that gets factored into the scores. So mm-hmm. now you can see, okay, this is how our monolingual English speakers score. But if they were moderately affected by another language, this is what would be a typical score. So it gives a psychologist something else to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that you don't use an interpreter for if you're getting a quantitative score. But if you want to get a qualitative score, you can have an interpreter there to see if it makes any difference.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, but for quantitatively, you just do it in English. Besides that, we also look at the BICS and CALP. We look at, so we have a BICS and CALP checklist. Mm-hmm. The Ortiz PVAT also gives a BICS and CALP results at the end, and we'll let you know where they are. But our BICS and CALP checklist, we also have points assigned to that too.
Right.
Catherine Collier highly recommends, and we do as well, to check the acculturation.
Mm-hmm.
So we do an acculturation quick screen because you want to know, has this student acculturated? Could that be an issue?
By acculturated, what do you mean by acculturated?
So how are they doing socially, emotionally, their family connections with the language, all of that. So how are they fitting in with the culture, and are they still like in culture shock?
Mm-hmm.
Are they in the midst of acculturating, or are they highly acculturated? So a student who's highly acculturated and is still performing, you know, a year, two, 3 years behind in second language acquisition, this is really an issue.
Yeah.
But it's somebody who's in culture shock may have a little bit more difficulty with the language. So we want to make sure that we are looking at that. Catherine Collier also has out there a resiliency screener. And so that will give you their strengths and their weaknesses. And what's great, what Catherine Collier has done, is when you look at the acculturation quick screen, then she accompanies it with like pages and pages. The teachers are always a little overwhelmed by how much there is there, but it's all strategies.
Yeah.
So you can take this back to the classroom and say, okay, this is what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different tools that are available, which is really nice, because it's no longer that we have no way to show it, right?
Right. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about the L identification process, because that's what you were referring to when you said you spend an hour just with the parents trying to get them to know the students and their language experiences.
Right.
And that information comes from the home language questionnaire.
Yes.
Right. And then you move on to the individual interview. And so I want to just emphasize for our listeners how important it is to follow those steps with fidelity in mm-hmm. the L identification process to begin with, before you even start talking about a disability.
Oh yeah.
Right. You know,
definitely. Yeah. So in our district, what we do is the registrar, if they see that there's another language on the HLQ, mm-hmm. they create what we call a red card.
Okay.
So the red card then has information on there about the other language, what language they want to be sent home, because that's really important as well. Mm-hmm. Because if they need an interpreter, the language sent home is not always the same. And sometimes right there, we have broken down the system between us and the parents. Mm-hmm. For example, we have many Nepali speakers who need interpreters, but they want the information sent home in English because they don't read in Nepali. So if we think we're doing the right thing by sending it home in Nepali,
yeah.
we have now made it so that they can't read it, but yet they have people in their community who can read English and then interpret it for them into Nepali.
Yeah.
So that's important. But that's all on our red card. The registrar will put all of that information. They'll also put it, as you know, we can't ask questions about when they entered the US. We can't ask questions about country of origin, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as educators, we want to know how much schooling have they had and where has that schooling been.
Right.
So on our red card, our registrar will list all schools attended, whether they were in the US or anywhere else. So that's nice because that gives us an idea now about their education.
Right.
And then I can follow up with that question when I do the interview. Of course, now I go through right from kindergarten, all their different schools.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I have to call the school that they just came from. But sometimes I have to go two schools back to get some information. So that actually helps as well. And that red card is actually red. And it goes into a file, but it also comes to me first. So now I know who needs to be called. Mm-hmm. And what she will do is she will not determine if they need to take the NICETEL, obviously, but she won't even determine anything. She will just tell me if there's a language listed anywhere in the HLQ.
Other than
English. And then I'll take it from there. Because sometimes the registrars will just look at that number one or two and then determine it and then say, okay, you don't need this one. So what we say is, no, if there's anything on there, just send it on to me. Because we have found that students will come from another New York State district, put English now for the student.
Yeah.
Another language for the parent. Now, if they came from another school district, obviously I can't question the parent. I can't question what they wrote on there. Mm-hmm. But if they came from another New York State district and I see that the parent speaks another language, I can see if they were ever an L. Mm-hmm. And we have found some emerging L's, but unfortunately, you know, it's a confusion for the parents because they're like, well, no, my child speaks English now.
Right.
So it's really that whole initial process is really important.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying and sharing, you know, your process and the importance of that and all of those resources there. I'll try to compile them all and share them with our recording.
Yeah. There's also sociocultural checklists, dynamic assessment protocols.
So let's talk about your work with MTSS. I know that in and of itself is an interesting process.
Mm-hmm. So as I spoke about before, we have the language difference versus disability team.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been together for 5 years. Last year, our focus was creating a multi-tiered system of support for our L's, because that's what we needed to make sure was really in place. So, as we talked about in the beginning, is it the student or is it the instruction, right? Mm-hmm. Is it an issue with the student or is it an issue with that we are not meeting the needs of a second language learner or a new language learner? The Office of Special Education came out with briefs for the multi-tiered system of supports. Mm-hmm. So that is where we started, and that's where I would recommend if people want to put this in place, mm-hmm. is to look for those briefs from the Office of Special Education.
Okay.
And we really dug deep into those briefs to see what is there, how can we create a process for Rush Henrietta. And when everybody was reading what was in the briefs, and this year we had a lot of coaches on the team, meaning literacy coaches and math coaches,
mm-hmm.
and they get to go into a lot of different classrooms being coaches. And I think the main focus was tier one, that mm-hmm. tier one is not always in place, and that is where we need to really focus our efforts and making sure that we have a consistent tier one across the district,
mm-hmm.
and that everybody is on the same page for that.
Right.
So when we created tier one, we started out with, okay, the best way to get tier one accomplished is with collaboration and co-teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we have co-teaching.
Right.
You know, of course, especially in the integrated classes, but we want to make sure that it's being done with fidelity and in the best way possible. So creating PDs and making sure that co-teaching is happening in all the different ways that co-teaching should happen. So that's number one priority. And to go along with that, professional development, mm-hmm. right? So you can't expect people to understand second language acquisition if you don't provide them with professional development on the topic. So how are we going to do that? And we've done that in a number of different ways, doing workshops, ENL teachers, of course, connecting with the mainstream teachers. I go into the buildings and present. We create videos, put them online, and offer CTLEs for them. So mm-hmm. we have a lot of different ways. And then from there, you know, making sure these are all parts of tier one. So co-teaching is part of tier one. Professional development is part of tier one. Making sure that the ENL services are appropriate. which, you know, you want to make sure that they're getting exactly what they need in exactly the areas that they need. That's all part of tier one. And I'm sure that that's what everybody is doing already, right?
Yeah.
So now the part that was all being done and it was being done well. Mm-hmm. The part that we really wanted to bring in was that first language access. Mm-hmm. So that became really important for us. And looking at all the research and how important that first language is and how important it is to be using it in the classroom and connecting with it and letting these students translanguage throughout the day.
Right.
And I think that's a hard thing for teachers to be able to do.
Yes.
So we did a lot of simulations for teachers in which they would learn in a different language and it would be scaffolded for them so they would understand. And then we would have them discuss, but they weren't allowed to discuss in English. Mm-hmm. And it was really difficult for them.
I bet, right? Yeah.
And you see all these faces and people starting giggling and, you know, they don't know what to do.
Right.
And then we're like, okay, discuss in English. And it's amazing when they were able to discuss in English, how much they were able to answer about what they just learned in Arabic. Okay. So. Mm-hmm. What that showed them was how when we cut off that first language,
right,
for our students, we cut off their higher level thinking, right? We're not allowing them to think at that level. We're bringing them down to this level that they can't have that type of thinking in. Right. So I think that was real eye-opening for our teachers.
Sure.
You know, we even discussed how if you and I have two different languages and so I'm speaking Arabic and you're the teacher and you know English. If you just let me talk in Arabic, I still can be thinking, right? And talking to you, even if you don't understand what I'm saying,
right?
You're giving me that ability to think it through. Mm-hmm. So because many teachers were nervous about that. And then we recently looked at a tool that we're looking at. It's called Pocket Talks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've I found out about that at Nice Teasel. The Pocket Talks is you push a button and you speak in your language and they hear you in whatever language you put.
Yes.
And then you push the button, they speak in that language and you hear it in English. So that would be really nice for teachers when want to have these conversations or pairing them up to do a pairing and a turn and talk, right?
Right.
So there's ways around things.
And that certainly would alleviate the teacher's concern that, well, I don't understand what they're saying. So how do I know they're understanding
right
teaching them?
Right. Yep. So. Yep. And what I say to that too is, well, you didn't understand you don't know if they understood before either, but now you're giving them a little bit of a chance.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So, and the same thing with us. Say, well, I don't know what those two Arabic speakers are speaking about over there. I said, well, do you know what the other two monolingual English speakers are speaking about over that corner? You know, if you're over here, no. So, you know, sometimes you just have to take a leap of faith.
Yes.
So then what we also wanted to make sure was happening is that instruction was culturally and linguistically appropriate. Mm-hmm. And we have a checklist that goes along with all these MTSSs, with the MTSS. Mm-hmm. So not only teachers don't have to say, yes, it's happening, no, it's happening. They have to give evidence of like what they're using, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So it's yes, this is a scaffold we use, or yes, this is how we made sure it was culturally appropriate, or this is how we made sure it was linguistically appropriate. Mm-hmm. Accountable talk is a big bang for your buck with ELLS. So we want to make sure that that is happening in the classroom. If that's not happening, go back and give that a try. I can give you the links to that too. Using non-linguistic tools. So we really showed teachers that scaffolds don't have to be crazy and time consuming. It can be as easy as a facial gesture, it can be as easy as moving your hands, drawing a picture, things like that. So we went over those types of non-linguistic schools.
Yep.
Linguistic load, are the teachers adjusting the linguistic load?
Right.
We looked at, have you ever heard of Rewordify?
Yes.
Okay, so we looked at using Rewordify for some, and just different tools that you can use to reduce linguistic load, maybe using a simplified text, but making sure that you have the same goal as the class,
right.
But maybe you're just giving other ways to access it.
Right.
So you're not, you're scaffolding, you're not dumbing down the lesson, or, you know, you are simplifying it to a point where they can access it. So, and then scaffolded lessons, you know, making sure that all of the lessons are scaffolded appropriate for their level. And what we did is we took differentiating instruction and assessment, English language learners. It's by Fairbairn and Jones. Mm-hmm. So this book has a great visual, with different scaffolds for entering, emerging, transitioning, and expanding. So what we did as a district is just kind of, we scaffolded it for the teachers and we kind of simplified it a little bit so that it's easier, because it can be a little overwhelming to read.
Right.
And put it into charts so that we have a link on our MTSS and a teacher can say, okay, well, what does a scaffold look like for an entering student? And you can click on that and, okay, this is what it looks like. But making sure that those scaffolds are not, they should be a moving target all year long. Mm-hmm. So if a student is entering, you shouldn't be using entering scaffolds in May.
Right.
And I think that that's an important point to remember, because many people will keep using the same scaffolds all year long, and you need to be moving them along, because the student should be moving through at least a level.
Yeah. And those scaffolds have to be removed as they progress.
Yes.
That's the purpose of a scaffold.
Exactly. And then monitoring them based on the NISA-SLAT level descriptors. Mm-hmm. So we have a chart that we can go to and you can see, okay, this is what is expected. These are the targets of measurement for the NISA-SLAT for entering, emerging, transitioning, expanding for that grade level.
Yes.
Right. Yep. And then on that chart, we have links to everything as well, so that teachers have like one-stop shopping. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all. And then at the end, and also in tier one, our ENL teachers give progress, language acquisition progress reports at the end of each quarter. So that's all tier one. None of that's tier two.
Right.
That should be for all else.
Right. And I think there's a bit of confusion too about the relationship between ENL services and MTSS. Like whether that's a tier three, is that considered tier three?
That's tier one. That's tier one. That's what an L gets, right? So that's tier one for an L. If you were giving 72 minutes a day of service to a non-L, that would be tier three, but that's what's expected. Mm-hmm. That's their service. That's tier one for an L.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. Because I think it is a common source of misunderstanding, I think, or a common source of confusion that, you know, that they need to be moved up on those tiers just because they're English language learners.
That's tier one. And if you're giving them AIS, now that would be a tier two.
Right.
Right. Because that's in addition, and AIS should always be in addition to.
Correct.
Not in place of.
Yes.
Should always be in addition to their ENL minutes.
Right.
Their ENL minutes cannot be counted as AIS. That's also a confusion that people have. I hear often. And then from there, that was all tier one.
Right.
So then what would tier two look like? So for tier two, that's going to apply to any of our L's who are falling below grade level expectations and the end is underlined, okay, because most of our L's are going to fall below grade level expectations when they're new, right? But that doesn't mean that they need tier two yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's and below expectations for a second language acquisition. So it has to be both.
Right.
It has to be both. Right. So if you have an entering emerging learner who is below grade level expectations for reading, they don't need AIS. They need their ENL support, right? If they are following normal second language acquisition, this is just part of the growth process. They just need time. But if you have a student who, say, is transitioning and is still performing like an entering or emerging L and is having difficulty with reading, now this would be when you're going to be making sure that they get that AIS support.
Right.
So in tier two, that's when we start taking that Catherine Collier grid. Remember I told you we put it now across modalities and across levels. We made our own way of looking at it with the visual, with the green, red, and orange. That's when we start really pinpointing goals. So if a student is not achieving grade level and not achieving normal second language development, that's when we go to an instructional support team, or we talk with the teachers and we start making very specific goals for that student based upon their second language acquisition and the gaps that they have. And then what scaffolds. So what is their language goal? What are the scaffolds that are going to be used? And what is the content goal? And put it all together.
Right.
And for all the different modalities.
Right.
And then we monitor that. Because sometimes, and of course, we beef up tier one, right? So the first thing we do is review tier one and see if there's any gaps there before moving to tier two. Because it could be that there's a gap in tier one instruction. And then when we start picking out those goals, now we have to create how often are we going to monitor it and all of that.
So moving between all of these levels is very intentional, extremely intentional.
Yes, with caution. And as a team. So it's not the ENL teacher. We're all teachers of ELS.
Right.
So it's the ENL teacher. It is the mainstream teacher. It is, if needed, the reading teacher, speech path, anybody who may factor into the student's profile. Right. And if we do determine that there is AIS, then that also needs to be following those tier one supports, right? So, so if a student needs reading, it can't just be, okay, here's Wilson, we're gonna do straight Wilson with you. It has to be, okay, this is the program that we use, but what is needed to make it more appropriate for this student, right? So that's when we were talking about before. You know, you may want to be looking at that student's individual language. Okay. And we have, there's a book called Language Difference versus Disorder, and it has nice Venn diagrams for different languages. And this language has these sounds, English has these sounds, and then in the middle of the Venn diagram, these are the sounds that they both have. So you want to start with the sounds that they both have, make sure that they're there. But if it sounds that English has and their language doesn't have, they may need to be explicitly taught. And that might be why they're having trouble with decoding.
Right. Yep.
And encoding. So they may need that explicitly taught. And can they even hear the difference? So you want to make sure of that. So you want to work with the reading teachers. Yeah. And explain what might be different for the student. Syntax would have to be explicitly taught to some of these students.
Right.
So, you know, making sure that when they are being taught reading, that it's always connected to meaning, right? So that they pre-taught some of that vocabulary. They're not just decoding words and it's not attached to something, that they really know what the meaning is.
Right.
So again, it's always working as a team. It's working as a team.
Yes.
And creating those goals. And then we have another thing that we created in our team is called the additional baseline data sheet. And on the additional baseline data sheet, that's where we keep all of this information. And that's what you would bring to IST, that's what you would bring to CSE. So we have several questions that you have to answer first to see if they would even qualify. You know, are the parents worried? Or is there an issue in the first language? All of that. So you have that from that first interview.
Right.
What is the child's dominant language? Because as we know, language dominance changes.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have been Nepali dominant in kindergarten, but this is fourth grade now, and they're now English dominant. Yes, there's still an L, but their dominance has changed. So that's important for when a psychologist is going to be doing testing.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that you have that on there. We have charts for their quartile growth for the NICES SLAT, their modality growth for the NICES SLAT. We do their peer comps on the additional baseline data sheet. We have the Ortiz PVAT is not until tier three. Because that is more of an assessment, and our special ed coordinator indicated that could be more of a predetermination. So we don't want to do that until there's a CSE referral.
Gotcha.
But we do the BICS and CALP, we do the socio-cultural checklist, we do all of those things on the additional baseline data sheet in tier two to see is this a student that we want to take to the next level,
right,
which is tier three. And tier three doesn't have to be special ed. It could also just be more intense services.
That's good to note.
But it's a possible referral. Mm-hmm. That all being said, what we pointed out to our staff and the director of special ed board pointed out, if there is a student that it is in desperate need, and this is very, like the student that comes in and has no language, has no eye contact, has no, there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. You don't have to bring them through every tier. That would be malpractice to do that, right? So this is for your student that it's difficult to see the difference.
Right. Wow. This has been very, very informational. And I think we could probably talk for another hour. But if you were to give advice to maybe someone who might be interested in creating their own MTSS system, mm-hmm, within their district, what first steps would you recommend?
I would say the first steps would be to look at the briefs that are out there from the Office of Special Education. Mm-hmm. Great first step. Don't look at them just by yourself. See if you can get a team that looks at them together. If you're working, if you're an ENL teacher who works in a building,
mm-hmm,
reach out to your principal after reading them and see if you can get them interested in it. I would also recommend two great books. Catherine Collier's 7 Steps to Separating Difference from Disability.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is Why Do English Language Learners Struggle with Reading? Distinguishing Language Acquisition from Learning Disabilities.
Okay.
That's by Hoover, Baca, and Klingner.
Okay.
And then if you want to beef up your co-teaching, of course, Honingsfield and Dove.
Yes.
So those are all great books to do study groups on. And then also that the book that I referenced before, The Differentiating Instruction and Assessment for English Language Learners.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look online, Catherine Collier has many of her resources for free online. Crowley also has a lot out there.
Okay.
I would say creating a team, looking at the Catherine Collier checklist, looking at the briefs, making sure your co-teaching collaboration is strong,
right,
and connecting with your principal.
Thank you so much, Jamie. I really appreciate all of the information that you've shared today, and I think we've got a robust set of resources here that we can share with our listeners. So I thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.